This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Lynn Cox loves cold water and is considered one of the world's greatest open water swimmers. She swam the Bering Strait in 1987 in the height of the Cold War. She swam the frigid waters of the Antarctic and the icy waters of Disko Bay in Greenland. This is just a partial list of her many swimming accomplishments. Lynn Cox's ability to perform and survive in these conditions has made her an unusual athlete. We asked her to join us today in Radio Times to discuss her many swimming feats and to share with other endurance swimmers and triathletes what she has learned over the years. She's got a new book. It's a swimming manual called Open Water. And Lynn Cox, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty. I'm so happy to be here.
You know, I have to say, you don't look like the Olympic swimmers that we are used to seeing when we do watch the Summer Olympics, with these gigantic shoulders and these long, lean bodies, tiny little hips. Your body's very different.
My body's meant for doing long distances in cold water. There's a little bit of extra body weight to insulate me, but also it's part of the way the body conditions and trains for the cold.
And is this, I mean, this is the body that you've always had, even as a little girl. I'm realizing, of course, there are anatomical changes over the years.
Yeah, always. I've always been really able to withstand the cold, and it's because I'm a little bit short and a little bit round, and it makes all the difference in being able to hold the heat in the core of my body and help keep me warm.
But there are a lot of short and round people in this world. But there must be something unique, though, about your body.
Well, actually, I trained for many, many, many years. I swam across the English Channel when I was 15 years old. And when I was training for that swim, I learned how to acclimate to the cold. My dad was a radiologist and suggested that I would sleep at night with the windows in my bedroom open and with the sheets on my bed, just no blankets and very light pajamas, so that I could get used to colder air temperatures. And during the daytime, I'd wear sandals instead of shoes, and I would do things that would make me more susceptible to the cold, so that when I was swimming across the English Channel in 56-degree water, it wouldn't be as difficult as if I hadn't conditioned for it.
But were you, or are you, one of those people that in the middle of winter just don't choose to wear a winter coat or a sweater or a hat or boots or all the things that we do when we bundle up in cold weather?
Well, I actually try to use less clothing and less coats and all that if I'm training for a big swim, but I think that when I live in California,
I don't really worry about that
not too much. Although, you know, the ocean temperature gets down to 50 degrees in the winter, maybe even 48. And what I learned through the years to do is just to train in the ocean and not train in the pool at all, because you tend to overheat and you don't acclimate very well.
I was reading about you and including descriptions, I think, from some of your siblings, where they would see you, I mean, as a little girl, outside swimming in the cold.
Right. Actually, one of the things that happened in Manchester, New Hampshire, was we were training with Ben Merritt, who was the Harvard coach, and it was a day when it was freezing cold out, and everyone got out of the pool except for two of the Harvard swimmers and me, and I asked the coach, can I just stay here and swim? And he said, okay. The temperature drops quickly because a storm was approaching, and it started raining, and the two older swimmers from Harvard got out of the pool, and I was 9 years old, and I just kept swimming on my own, and there were wind waves in the pool, and it started hailing, and I climbed into the gutters and waited for the hail to stop, and then went back in and just enjoyed being there in this big pool all alone as the storm raged across the area. And I just thought, wow, this is so much fun.
And you weren't cold?
I wasn't. I mean, I feel the cold just like anyone else. I go outside and it's cold out, I feel cold, but basically I learned not to focus on that. I learned to focus on what I'm training for and what I'm doing. And I think if you go, oh my gosh, it's cold, it's cold, it's cold, then you feel cold. But if you think, oh my gosh, I want to swim across the English Channel, you focus on swimming across the English Channel.
Well, and you have swum across the English Channel. You've swum in so many different parts of the world, New Zealand, South Africa, off the coast of Chile, the Arctic, the Antarctic. Have you train for one of these really cold swims?
It really changes through time. You know, initially it was I would be able to only swim. When I went to swim the Straits of Magellan, for example, I was only able to train in 50-degree water, so it was a huge difference to go from 50 to 42 degrees. But there was no way around it because I was going to UC Santa Barbara, and that's where I was going to college, and that was as cold as the water got. So when I got down to Punta Arenas, Chile, the first day I got into the water, I just stood there for 20 minutes and stood there until it came up to my shoulders and thought, oh my gosh, this is much colder than I thought it would be. This is really, really, really hard. And so the next day I thought, okay, I stood there for 20 minutes. Now I can try to swim for 20 minutes. So that's what I did. I kept adding 10 minutes to a point where I could swim for an hour.
Wow.
And then on the actual day of the swim, I swam from Tiao de Fuego to the mainland of Chile, and it started to snow when I was starting the swim, and it was really challenging, but because of the gradual progression and the training that I'd done prior to that and all the other swims, I was able to be the first person to make that swim.
I was reading that I think below the 60 degrees, the blood rushes from, I guess, our extremities into our organs. Why doesn't this hurt you?
Well, actually,
I don't know how else to ask.
It doesn't hurt me. Basically, my body's learned how to close down the blood flow peripherally and under the skin, and then move it into the core to protect the vital organs and my brain. And I also train and I exercise it as 80% of my maximum. So I'm working really, really hard, and my muscles are strong and they're large. And so what I'm doing is creating heat through that muscular activity. So there are two things going on there. I'm creating the heat metabolically, but also I'm able to close down the blood flow peripherally and keep it closed down. And I'm able to generate more heat than I lose. But if I stop for any period of time, I will lose heat really rapidly. And so on my long swims, I choose to not feed very often, and I choose to keep going just to keep the heat up.
But do you feel numb? I mean, if you're swimming in 40, 42, or even colder?
Yes, I do. I mean, when I swam in Antarctica in 32-degree water, the moment I jumped into the water to swim from the ship to the shore there, my goal was to swim the first Antarctic mile.
Right.
My skin went completely numb, and my hands felt much like wood, and I just turned over very quickly. And I also realized that you lose 80% heat through your head. So I swam head up to try to, like a water polo player, to try to keep more heat in the body.
I have a childhood memory of being with my family in Glacier National Park and jumping into one of those, what I thought was just a lovely, beautiful lake. And to this day, I mean, I don't know how cold it was. It was really cold. To this day, I remember how my body, I almost jumped out of my skin. That's what it felt like.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like that. And the thing the thing is that when you're going into water temperatures that low, you really don't know completely what to expect.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to train for that because there's not a lot of places where you can train in 32-degree water.
Yeah. I'm curious about your brain. I mean, sort of how you keep yourself... You just rolled your eyes at me. What happens to your brain, I guess, under these conditions? As you said, you keep your head out of the water for lots of good reasons, but nonetheless, it's got to have an impact on your mental function.
There's a whole lot that goes into these swims. I mean, for the Bering Strait, I think it was something like 15 or 20 years of training in colder waters and then actually doing the Bering Strait, and that was 38 degrees. And then progressively, I did colder swims, and that was Antarctica in 32. And then off of Greenland in 2007, the water temperature was 28.8 and dropped down to 26.6. The thing is that I train as much as I can, and I get into water that is as cold as I can get so that I'm mentally prepared to do what I'm going to do. And if I don't train physically to do something, there's no way mentally I can do it. So there's this synergy that goes on, and if I'm not mentally ready to do something, then I'm not going to do it.
So what do you think about when you're doing, let's say you did this swim in 20, you know, in below freezing waters, what are you thinking about?
Actually, for the swim off Greenland, I was really focused on trying to get air because it was so cold, it was very hard to breathe. I didn't realize there'd be a huge difference between swimming in 32-degree water and 26.6, but it was like going to the moon and then going to Mars. It was enormous. And so I was thinking about, you know, are my fingers together or are they splaying? Are they coming apart? Because if they're coming apart, that means that I'm cooling down. That means that my fine motor control is going away and my brain isn't functioning well. I had the crew watching me. They were watching to see if my shoulders were starting to turn purple or if my lips were turning purple. And that meant that I was really cooling down fast. But I wasn't. That wasn't happening. And I just was working at as fast as I could go, swimming, turning over as quickly as I'd ever gone before. And the first swim I did in Greenland was a quarter of a mile, and that was just a 5-minute and 10-minute swim, 5-minute and 10-second swim. But then a month or so later, I went to Baffin Island, and the goal was to swim a mile. And it was sort of the mind thing. It was sort of a psych out when we first arrived there because the whole area was still frozen, solid. And I thought, oh, it's going to be hard to swim here. There's no water. But the other part that was so fascinating was that the Inuit who live in that area, because it's so cold there, the normal substance, water, is frozen. So they don't look at water as a liquid. They look at water as a solid. And we waited, I think it was 7 days, for the ice to break. And then when it did, I was able to have a kayaker go along with me through the ice as my rescue guy or my safety guy, and swam a mile in 28.8. And I was in the water for 23 minutes.
Wow.
And the other part, though, is that, I mean, it's not just about the challenge, it's about the research that's been done. There were a group of people, researchers at UC Santa Barbara went to college at the Institute of Environmental Stress to try to figure out how I acclimated to the cold, to figure out how to survive better in the cold. And there was all sorts of basic medical research that was going on that's being applied now and then at the University of London as well.
And what does it feel like after, let's say, you know, swimming through the ice there? What does it feel like when you get out of the cold?
Actually, you know, when you stop swimming, there's often what's called an afterdrop. And the cold blood from the peripheral part of your body under your skin starts to circulate back into the center of your body. And it cools you down really fast. And you start getting really cold really fast.
Wow.
And so when I did the Bering Strait, I learned from a Russian doctor, Rita Zakharova, that you put hot water bottles on your carotid arteries on your neck and then under your armpit and then the brachial arteries down by your lower part of your legs there. And then you would get in a sleeping bag and could warm yourself up from the inside out. What you never, ever want to do with somebody from the research that I did on this next book, there's an expert in the world named Gordon Giesbrot. You never want to take somebody who's hypothermic and put them into hot bath or hot shower because that can kill them. That can collapse the system. It can cause the cold water, a cold blood at the peripheral part of the body outside under the skin to go into the core very quickly and cool down everything so fast that it's really, really dangerous. So when I did the swim in Greenland, I was still trying to figure out better ways to rewarm because the idea of stopping and shivering for an hour is really, really miserable. The hot water bottles help because I was warming the central part through the arteries and using that. But what I decided to do was to keep moving. So my friends helped me get on my tracksuit or sweatsuit and put on shoes. And I walked through this town of Illilisit that was really, really hilly. And I kept the muscular activity going so that by the time I got back to the hotel, my core was warm. And then I got into a cool shower and warmed it up to hot within 20 minutes.
That's Lynn Cox, our guest today on Radio Times, considered the greatest open water swimmer, according to Sports Illustrated. And she joins us on Radio Times to talk about her adventures swimming in what, at least from my perspective, seem like treacherous waters around the world. She's the author of a new book. It's called Open Water Swimming Manual, an expert survival guide for triathletes and open water swimmers. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Chemical Heritage Foundation supports WHYY and presents a new art exhibit, Sensing Change. The 8 artists in Sensing Change explore and respond to both long-term climate change and daily shifts in our environment. Visitors can view a visual record of rainfall, interact with a digital wind map, and experience the microclimates of small-scale greenhouses. Exhibit information and video interviews with participating artists and atmospheric scientists at chemheritage.org/sensingchange.
Hi, I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. We host Sound Opinions, the world's only rock and roll talk show.
Jim and I review records and give the music news, and we also bring in bands for unique live performances.
I'll never forget when the young Chicago garage rockers, the Kathy Santonis, joined Weezer's Rivers Cuomo for a completely unrehearsed set. I wanna go back,
yeah. Wow, you guys pulled that off.
Monday nights at 10 on WHYY. I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, by October 1st, states are supposed to have their health exchanges up and running in order to enroll tens of thousands of uninsured residents. Some states have launched ad campaigns. Oregon's features local musicians. Others haven't been so aggressive. So where are we on the healthcare exchanges? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Lynn Cox, considered one of the world's greatest open water swimmers, or perhaps even the greatest. She has a new book, Advice for Long Distance Swimmers and Triathletes. It's called Open Water Swimming Manual. And we're talking about how she does, what she does, and frankly, how you can do it too. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I realize on a lot of these swims, you have people near you or keeping an eye on you. Nonetheless, do you like being alone in the open water?
I like to be swimming solo, but I also appreciate so much having the support crew. And what I've really learned is that they're so key into your being able to do well. When I swim across the English Channel for the first time, there was a pilot named Reg Brickle who had taken the most record-breaking swimmers across the English Channel. And he took me across, and I broke the time. So I think that it really does make a difference who you have in your crew and how capable they are. And they're also there to make sure the swim's safe. So I when I do the long swims, I really spend a lot of time trying to figure out who will work best in my crew. And for instance, when I did the swim in Antarctica, I knew it was really going to be challenging, but also risky.
Yeah.
And so I had three physician friends who came along there just in case there was a problem.
But do you want people to egg you on or to encourage you, or you just want them to be there to observe you as you're swimming?
All of the above.
All of the above. You need all the help you can get.
Exactly. There are times where when I swam across Cook Strait in New Zealand, after 5 hours of swimming, I was further from the finish than when I'd started. And so, you know, it was very discouraging.
I bet.
So, but there were people that called out to the ship to encourage me to keep going, and people on board the boat that jumped in and paddled with me or swam with me and kept me going. So all that was so helpful. But now when I train offshore, I will always go and check in with the lifeguards and find out what's the water quality today and are there problems out there? Are there jellyfish? Have you had any stings for stingrays? You know, and I will just sort of check out the area before I even get in the water.
I'm thinking of stingrays and jellyfish. What are the most dangerous things that you have to think about?
Well, those along the California coast, but also Florida and some other areas, stingrays are always a concern. And so what I learned from the lifeguards through the years is shuffle your feet on the way out into the ocean so you don't step down on them. So it just warns them, get out of the way.
Oh.
And they do. And then coming in, though, a lot of people just step down because they think that they've landed and they're done. But I've learned to like splash a whole lot and then put my feet down tentatively and then slide my feet coming into shore. Also, I learned that if you ever get stung, the best thing that the lifeguards tell you to do is put your foot in the hottest water you can stand, and they keep adding hot water because it breaks down the toxic sheath that is around the barb that may be ejected into your foot. So just knowing what to do, you know, is so helpful, but to prevent it is even better. One of the experts from Stanford who knows all about stings and bites and all that was somebody I went to for writing this book, and he suggested that if somebody gets stung by jellyfish, the best thing you can use is vinegar because it helps to break down the acid in the vinegar, helps to break down the nematocysts, the stinging cells. And so in this book, I spent a lot of time talking about, you know, how you're a guest in this ocean environment.
Sure.
And how amazing and beautiful it is, but also how to prevent getting hurt.
Yeah. You've swum in so many different waters around the world for a number of decades now. Has the water changed? I mean, we hear about global warming, we hear about sea rise. As someone who must know the ocean so intimately, do you see changes? Have you felt changes?
I do see changes. When I was swimming in I swam across Glacier Bay, Alaska, as a way to prepare for doing the Bering Strait swim. And I saw the glacier a lot smaller, you know, 15 years later. The cleanliness of the water, though, is changing. I have a friend who's a professor of marine biology at Cal State Long Beach, California, and we were talking about how life is coming back to a lot of the areas in the Pacific ocean and how the water is becoming cleaner and how people's efforts are making a difference. And I think that that's huge, and I think that people need to hear that, because there's different groups that have been really involved in water clarity and or quality. And I wound up doing a swim across the Ohio River a number of years ago, and the Sierra Club was involved in putting that on, and also the River Keepers. And they wanted to make sure that the water quality wasn't diminished by the standards that were created by the politicians. And so they asked if I'd come there to help to swim the river and bring in local swimmers to ask them to swim with me. And we did that. And there were 7,000 people who contacted local officials and said, we don't want you to drop the standards. We want you to clean up the river so that people can swim in it. So I think that, you know, the Surf Riders Association or Foundation is really involved in this. But I think that as more triathletes, as more swimmers, as more open water swimmers, other athletes get into the open water and are face-to-face with what they're swimming in, I think that there'll be more people that will have a greater impact and be able to change the way things are. And I think that's really optimistic and hopeful.
Well, Eva, I guess I want to have us join, have her join us in just a couple of minutes. One of the things I also read about you was that you are really skilled at swimming in a straight line. Is that true?
Yes, because I don't like to swim extra distances.
Really?
Yeah.
So you trained yourself to swim in a straight line.
Right. So the way I do it really is by breathing on both sides, because then I balance out my stroke. But I also am able to look around me. So if I look to my left and I look to my right, I can judge the distance I am. Off to the right, I might see houses or I'll see lifeguard stations. And so I'll use that as a judgment a distance from shore. And then off to the left, there might be oil islands, or there might be the pier, and I'll use that off to the left, the outer outside. So I stay between that, but I also often put, there's a station up on the pier or a house or a fishing station on the pier where I'll put that on my back and use that. So I'll breathe and I'll look backwards too. So those points help me triangulate and stay really on course.
So you don't have to exert any more.
Yes, I'm a lazy swimmer.
You're a lazy swimmer.
I'm a lazy swimmer.
I don't think so.
Well, maybe efficient. Maybe that's efficient. The better word.
Yeah. Somehow lazy doesn't seem to apply to our guest. Her name is Lynn Cox, considered the world's greatest open water swimmer. That's according to Sports Illustrated. She has swum all over the world, and she has a new book. It's a swimming manual. It's called Open Water, and it's subtitled An Expert Survival Guide for Triathletes and Open Water Swimmers. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. If you have any questions about how to swim in open water, Lynn Cox is your guest. Joining us now is Megan Wren, who swam 13 miles across the Delaware Bay this past weekend to raise awareness about the bay. And Megan Wren, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's nice to be here. Thrilled to be here with Lynn Cox and with you, Marty.
Well, we're happy to bring you two ladies together. I should say that Megan is founder, executive director of the Bayshore Center at Bivalve. Megan, have you ever swum 13.1 miles before?
No.
This was the longest swim before this one?
I did do a practice swim that was 11 and a half, but three of that was very much current assisted, so I really didn't know when I got in if I had it in me to make the whole 13.
Well, you did it in, I believe, 8 hours and 45 minutes. Is that right?
That's correct.
And how was it for you?
It was spectacular. It was everything went just how we hoped it would go. And I know it's always difficult to navigate to land where you want to land. I came out at the beach in Fortescue right where the tent was with our, you know, the friends at the other end. And it was, I wouldn't say a gorgeous day, but the very changing weather through the day, but it was all good.
Well, you had some wind that kicked up, as I understand, a little bit of rain as well.
Yeah, a couple little squalls, you know, not squalls, but a couple little rainstorms went through.
Well, let me get Lynn Cox back in on the conversation. And you're smiling broadly, Lynn Cox, as Megan Wren is describing her swim over the weekend.
It's so exciting to hear somebody have such a big goal and swim it. And there's always that hesitation, like, can I really do it? No matter what level you're at, and 13 miles is a big swim. So congratulations, yeah. Megan. That's so cool.
And why did you do this, Megan?
Well, it's been something I've been thinking about for quite some time. It almost seemed like something I was destined to do. I've been a swimmer all my life, and I've been working for the Delaware Bay for 25 years, so it seemed almost inevitable. But I became particularly passionate about doing it now. It seems like after Superstorm Sandy, things are very different in this area, and I really wanted to call attention to the Delaware Bay and the communities along the bay and their difficulty in recovering from the storm, and at the same time have something positive to celebrate, because the Delaware Bay is such a magical place. I wanted to draw attention to the bay itself and its people, and to encourage people to appreciate it as a as a recreational venue and as a place that has potential with its community life.
Well, I'm assuming you're talking about people, but also the wildlife that depends on the Delaware Bay as well, Megan.
Absolutely. And we have incredible resources here. And I know people that live in the Chesapeake area love their Chesapeake Bay. And for some reason, there doesn't seem to be as passionate a connection with the people to the Delaware Bay. And yet we've got all the same resources and even some extras. So it's, we have our horseshoe crabs and shorebirds that migrate through in the spring. We have, right now, there are just literally hundreds of thousands of purple martins massing as they get ready to fly south, and there are 300,000 of them were seen the day that I was swimming.
Wow. It's interesting because, Lynn, you were describing about swimming as sort of raising awareness about water quality and the environment that we share.
Yeah, it sounds like Megan's doing exactly that, and poetically and beautifully, and connecting to the people and the environment. And I was just thinking, you must have a lot of time to think about what you're doing and how you can make a difference. And that's so spectacular.
Well, and the fact that, Megan, you know this body of water so well. I mean, Lynn has swum all over the world, but this is a bay that you've really dedicated so much of your life to.
Yeah, a lot of people have said, what's next, the English Channel or the Chesapeake Bay? I'm contemplating other swims potentially, but they're going to be different sections of the Delaware Bay. You know, this is my place, and I don't aspire to be a worldwide, though I'm in awe of what Lynn has accomplished in her life. I'm very much a place-based person, and I'm really focused on the Delaware Bay.
And have you been a lifelong swimmer, Megan?
I have. I started competitively swimming when I was 7, and I actually grew up along the Jersey Shore in the summer times, and it was a pretty regular thing to swim across the channel in the Back Bay of Stone Harbor, and ocean swims. When I was competing, we'd often, in the summertime, do ocean swims just to kind of stay in shape.
And Lynn, how long have you been swimming?
Actually, I started swimming before I could walk.
Is that right?
Yeah, my parents had us learning, my brother and my two younger sisters and me, learning to swim in the bathtub. So the water was really controlled and clean, and we learned how to blow bubbles, which is the most important part of swimming, the breathing. And then from there, we went to this pond in Maine called Snow Pond, where my grandparents had a camp. Uh-huh. And we started swimming there as a family. And I think that's why I was so drawn back to that open water swimming, because for years I competed in a swimming pool and trained with the Olympic coach in Long Beach, California. And then he realized that I had this ability to go really long distances and said, why don't you think about swimming across the Catalina Channel? So that's how it all evolved.
And does your were your parents avid swimmers themselves?
Actually, my grandfather, my mother's father, was a huge swimmer, and he swam Lakes of Maine. He swam across the Hudson River. He just would work during the day and come back in the evening and swim in the lake with my mom. And so as kids, I think that my parents wanted to make sure that we loved swimming as much as they did, but also they wanted to make sure that we were safe.
Yeah. Yeah. Megan, do you do triathlons?
I do. I enjoy being outdoors, and it's a time to kind of get away. My job is actually fairly intense, managing a nonprofit organization in Cumberland County's poorest county. A lot of fundraising all the time, and I see triathlons as a way to kind of keep my head, have some personal time and
sure.
do something. And this was kind of a perfect way to marry the sport side of it with the my passion and the and my goals.
And I read that, or I heard that you had back surgery in 2009. Is that right?
I did. And prior to that, I would, anytime my back started hurting, I would kind of sit down or lie down and try to treat it carefully. And I'm so thankful to my surgeon who said that what I needed to do when I had pain was to move and walk and even run. He said that it was, I had been told before that I would never run again. And my surgeon said, I don't see why not.
Huh.
He said, I can't tell you that it's good for you, but I can't, you know, he was a runner himself. And he said, go for it. So I did a 5K a month after my surgery and never looked back. And any time I had any pain, I'd swim or bike or run.
Wow.
And I felt better and better.
And Lynn, do you do triathlons? I know your book in part is advice for people who do triathlons.
I'm a mono athlete. I admire the triathletes, and I've worked a lot with a lot of triathletes, but I am not a runner, and I am not a cyclist. I just, my body type is not made for that, and I just love to swim. I love to be in the water.
But I got the feeling reading through your book that there's a lot of crossover. I mean, there's a lot you could learn from a cyclist or a runner or people that do other sports besides open water swimming.
Actually, that's how I started out. When I was doing my open water swims, there were people, nobody was doing what I was doing. And so I would go to Olympic athletes that were runners or cyclists or involved in speed skating and ask them how they trained and what they ate and what they did. And so the book that I wrote is sort of the culmination of 40 years of gifts that people have given me, the knowledge to become an athlete and what I did. But then I went further than that and tried to incorporate what I learned from the U.S. Navy SEALs and how they trained and their specific, how they do management of risk and how they do certain procedures to make sure that they can do really extraordinary training but also do it safely. So
yeah.
I've incorporated a lot of different information that I had to learn all sorts of new stuff to write this book.
Well, we have to say goodbye to you, Megan Wren, but I read that your son's name is Del Bay. Do I have that right?
That's right.
Name for the Delaware Bay?
Yes, he is.
And how does he feel about that?
Well, he doesn't love it. I hope that when he gets a little older, he will appreciate it more, but he will often introduce himself to others as his name of the day and pick something else.
Oh, that's interesting. And is he a swimmer?
He's getting there. I should have started him earlier, I think. I didn't start till he was two, and he resists putting his head under. But he's getting better and better.
Well, Megan Wren, congratulations, and thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much. It was a thrill.
A thrill for us as well, because you swam 13.1 miles from Delaware to New Jersey last Saturday in 8 hours and 45 minutes, again raising awareness about the Delaware Bay. And Megan Wren, founder and executive director of the Bayshore Center at Bivalve. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We're almost up on a break here, Lynn, but I just got, as I was watching you as Megan was talking about her experiences, just this sense of wonder and appreciation for people to do what you do.
I think that there's this great community of open water swimmers, and we just appreciate what everyone else is doing, and we want to share those experiences and hear about, because they're still great adventures. I mean, somebody might be doing their first half mile swim, and it's huge, because when you leave land, it's a whole new experience. And when you go beyond, you know, 13 miles, there's a lot of mind, body, and spirit that's working on succeeding.
That's Lynn Cox, our guest today in Radio Times. Another short break. We'll get back to our conversation. Also, open up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. If you have ever contemplated an open water swim, or perhaps you're a triathlete, give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Next time in Studio 360, the former First Lady of France. Carla Bruni sings, she acts, and she's kind of funny.
I don't think it's the same to sing in Italian, in French, or in German. French people are Italian people in a bad mood.
Carla Bruni plays songs from her new album, And I Briefly Fall in Love, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Hi, welcome to the law offices of Saul Goodman & Associates. From parking tickets to mass murder, from slip and fall to bond fraud, Saul Goodman and Associates.
That's the character Saul Goodman, the sleazy lawyer from Breaking Bad, which returns Sunday. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Bob Odenkirk about playing Saul. Better Call Saul on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The great American pastime looks to bring down the hammer on one of its biggest stars, the fate of Alex Rodriguez, the faltering Yankees, and can baseball save itself? The commish swings for the bleachers, but there's not a lot of folks in the stands. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and if you're just joining us, Lynn Cox is our guest. She has swum across the Cook Strait, the Strait of Magellan, Lake Titicaca, even the frozen Bering Strait, considered one of the world's greatest open water swimmers, something she's been doing for many years now. We've been talking about how she does what she does, swimming in what could be treacherous waters with jellyfish and stingrays, even hypothermia. And I do want to talk a bit about some of the advice that she has in her new book called Open Water Swimming Manual, an expert survival guide for triathletes and open water swimmers. And again, we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. I like you right here into the open water. Going from swimming pool to open water swimming is like going from a fish tank to the ocean.
It's actually so freeing to go from this area where everything's controlled and still, and there's a black line. And whenever you talk to somebody who's in a different sport and they talk about swimming in the pool, they think, oh my gosh, it's so boring. I can't stand doing that. And so I was thinking about that the other day, and I thought, you know, I am seeing more runners and cyclists getting into open water swimming because it's more like cycling and running is, where they get to be out in the environment and influenced in it, or inspired by it, and they see the changes, and they see the clouds, and they see the blue sky, and everything moving and shifting just like the open water. So there are people that are now going, okay, I've done a lot of running, I've done a lot of cycling, but now I want to try something new. And also they're learning when they hurt themselves that the best place to be is in the water. If it's not an open cut or something like that, often doctors will say, you know, go in the water, it'll help you rehab, it'll help you stretch you out. And actually my dad was a radiologist, and so whenever we would hurt ourselves, you know, I broke my feet in gymnastics. It was like, go in the pool, you know. I broke my elbow in gymnastics. No, actually, that was in basketball. It's like, go in the pool. And I found that I was much safer in the pool than I was anywhere else. But also, I would just put a kickboard underneath my elbow, and within 6 weeks, it healed, and I had full range of motion again. Wow. Whereas back then, when it happened, they used to believe, cast it and don't let it move. And his thought was, let it just be supported and kick, and that way you'll be able to stay in the water, have your feel for the water, and then you'll get healthier faster.
What do you wear when you're swimming? Then we'll get to our callers.
When I do my swims, I wear a swimsuit, cap, and goggles. The swimsuit I usually wear is made out of Lycra because it chafes less than the nylons or the polyester swimsuits. And that's really important because when you're doing long swims, you can start getting cut around your neck from the swimsuit. And with the guys, it's the top of the swimsuit or the leg holes, it really chafes. And I think that the Lycra suits chafe less. But if you're doing really, really long swims, it helps to put Vaseline around the holes of the suit, the armholes or the leg holes of the suit, to be able to reduce the friction.
You were telling me that some of these long-distance swimmers, some of the women are swimming topless because I guess it's easier that way.
Right. Actually, years and years ago when I first started doing these different swims, my neck would be all cut up from the swimming straps. So my mom suggested putting elastic band around my waist and then dropping my straps. Right. And that's what the other swimmers did with me. They're the female swimmers. And so years and years and years later, I've met this group of older women, you know, in their 30s, 40s, 50s, even 60s, who swim together. And they said they wear two-piece tops and they just take off their tops and put it on the paddleboard. And the guy paddling for them is like cool with it. And they just do their workout and they don't chafe. So I think that people just decide, you know, we need to be comfortable when we're training. We'll do whatever we need to do that.
Well, there's nothing better than swimming naked in the water, right?
Yeah.
Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Lynn from Bethlehem. Lynn, go ahead, your Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning. I'm a big fan. My name is also L-Y-N-N-E.
There you go.
And coincidentally, my grandmother was married to a man named Don Cox.
Oh, wow.
C-O-X. So, and I fancy myself a swimmer, but I'm calling, I mean, I've done some open water myself, but I'm calling for Lynn to ask her about her time and her communication with the whales.
Oh,
and how, and you know, how magical and how mysterious and how wonderful a time that was. I read her book, Grey Sun, and was very touched by that.
Lynn, thanks for the call. Yeah, go ahead, Lynn.
Yeah, actually, I think that that was one of the best experiences I ever had when I was doing open water swimming, because I was training off the coast of California in an area called Seal Beach, and I was in the water in the very early morning before the sun had risen, and now I would never do that. But as a, you
why
know,
not?
Because I think you need to have lifeguards watching you, you need to have support boats around, or kayakers, or somebody, or another swimmer, but the idea of swimming alone in dark water is not really smart. But I wasn't really smart at age 17. I've learned a whole lot since. And so I was swimming and suddenly felt this huge hole in the water below me. And I get a little scared because I thought maybe it's a shark. So I moved a little closer to shore and figured out that, you know, if I psych myself out now, then I'm not going to be able to swim Catalina again. So I kept swimming and I felt this presence around me and I felt the water hollow out again. And I finished with the first half mile of the swim, and I turned around and I sprinted back to the pier and thought, I'm just going to finish this and get out of the water now. I'm going to shorten the workout. And there was an old man who was a fisherman who worked on the pier in the bait shop, and he called me over and said, look, Lynn, there's a baby whale who's lost his mom, and he's following you. And if you go ashore, he'll follow you ashore, and he will die because his lungs will collapse. So you need to stay out here in the water and help him find his mother. So I'm like, okay, I'll do that. But the thing was like, how do you find a mother whale in the ocean, you know?
Exactly.
But what I thought I would do is just stay with him. And I thought that that would be the solution because I couldn't think of what else to do. So for 5 hours, we swam around the pier and off the pier, and he dove into very deep water. And I wrote all about this experience because I just thought it was so amazing that he stayed with me for that time. And then at one point, I started getting really cold and decided that I had to swim back to shore. And he swam back in near shore with me. And the story is very happy ending. She winds up coming and finding the baby.
The mom
finds the baby whale, and they swim off. And so I wrote very poetically about this, but also there was a lot of thought that went into what do you do? Do you just leave somebody behind? Do you stay with them? You know, so I wrote the story in a way that there were different levels of understanding or I hope that somebody would get from it. But I also was so excited because it's been translated now into 20 different languages. So what I think that people realize is that there is a connection between us and marine mammals. And there was one point that I wrote about where Grayson rolled over and looked at me with his eye, and it was like the size of a baseball. And, you know, it was as if he was looking at me to say, who are you? And I was looking at him to think, you know, oh my gosh.
Good question.
Yeah, and it was also intimidating because he was about 17 or 18 feet long. And so I was a little scared because, you know, little puppies sometimes jump on you. And I thought, will he have a sense of I'm not a big being and you know, will I be okay with him? And he kept a distance from me. Well, actually, at one point, he let me touch him. And I had years before, not that many years before, maybe the year before, I'd been invited to go to an area where there was a tank of dolphins, and I had a chance to touch the dolphins. And so the Grayson felt very much like the dolphins, but the skin almost felt a little bit tighter, like it, as if you were touching a mushroom.
And so was it just a matter of just being with him? I mean, or were you doing what you do when he was following along with you?
No, actually, I really wanted to stay by the pier and wait and hope the mom would retrace her fluke, you know, that she would come back from where she had gone and find him. And but he started swimming offshore, and I thought, well, maybe he heard her. Maybe, you know, because they communicate and the sound travels through the water. And so I didn't know what was going on, but I just thought, I'll swim offshore with him and wait with him. And then he would dive down underwater and disappear. And I'd think, well, do I stay here or do I go? Do I wait or what do I do? And then at one point when I started getting really cold, I think he recognized that because he swam with me back to the pier. And when you're a swimmer, you learn that you can draft off of other swimmers, that if you stay very close, you're pulled along in the slipstream. And so I just swam in a slipstream back toward the pier. And it was one of those amazing moments in life, though, where you realize that you can make a difference just if you stay there, you know?
Grayson. You called him Grayson.
Yeah. Because he was the son of the gray whale. So he became Grayson to me. I named him immediately. He was a being. He wasn't just a big fish. And it was really significant.
Lynn, thanks for that call. Let's see what Paul from Havertown has to say. Paul, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
I've done two half Ironman triathlons, which is a 1.2-mile swim. But over the weekend, my son had a very special experience of swimming in the ocean at Assateague Island, and it was probably about a half a mile course. But it is rather disconcerting being in the ocean. What advice do you have for knowing what your abilities are? Even the second day we swam, there was a bit of a wind out of the north, and it made a huge difference in how fast we could go the same route. And you know, how do you also cope with trouble when you're way out there, like with cramps or fatigue? If you have any advice on that,
sure, thank Paul. You. Paul, before you go, I mean, did you guys make it?
Oh yeah. It was a bit tougher the second day. The first day, the ocean was extremely calm. The second day, there was a fairly not even that strong of a wind out of the north, but sure made the swim a bit harder. And by the way, Assateague Island is just an absolutely great place, especially to camp down there.
Indeed. Well, Paul, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Lynn, any advice?
I think that the best thing you can do is to train in a variety of different conditions. And so, for instance, when I swam across the Straits of Magellan, there were huge tidal changes. And so what I tried to do is, when I was training to do the Straits of Magellan, I swam during the huge tidal changes, which were not as much as what I'd experienced in the Straits of Magellan. But I would also train late afternoon, when it was really, really rough. And so I had to learn to swim through the base of the waves, and I didn't get airborne. I changed my stroke according to what the conditions of the water were. The other thing that I learned actually from the U.S. Navy SEALs when I watched them train was that they don't swim way offshore. They swim just parallel to shore. They find no need to cross areas of water unless they have boat support. And even in their training, they have boat support, jet skis, they have basically an ambulance and a corpsman and all sorts of people there, and they have the ability to pull smoke and signal that there's an emergency, and people always swim with buddies. So while watching them, I learned that just in their basic workouts and their training things, everything is done with the idea of minimizing the risk and with complete professionalism. So I think that, you know, if you're doing swims across waterways, it's really important to have boat support, kayak support. If you have kayak support, the kayakers have to be really proficient and able to flip over the kayak and put your arms on top and then roll the kayak over and put you on the bottom of the kayak and then paddle you to shore if there's an emergency, or there needs to be some kind of life jacket to pull you, or a harness that the lifeguard buoys use. The lifeguards use the buoys to pull you to shore. So you have to make sure that you have the crew there that's helping you out.
And what about things like cramps?
Cramps usually, from what I've learned and seen and experienced, cramps usually occur because, one, you're kicking harder than you have before, and so you're working the muscles harder than you used to. Maybe there are a couple things you can do is you can back off on the kicking, because swimming is probably 90% arms, and kicking is more balance. I mean, the stroke is more balanced than anything else. So if you're kicking really hard, you're using up a whole lot of oxygen, and you're not using that oxygen to pull yourself forward. The other thing is that maybe your electrolytes are off.
Right.
And so, you know, you can train and work out that and see how that is effective.
Paul, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What do you eat before a big swim, or do you eat?
Actually, I do. I didn't used to, but I usually will have a bagel with peanut butter and jelly because that's something that stays with me for a very long time. And I've talked to friends of mine who do marathon runs and ultra marathon runs, the 100 miles and beyond. and that's what they also eat, that they you get this mix of protein, carbohydrate, and fat. And so when you do these long-distance swims, or at least they figured out with me that I use carbohydrate and fat as my main burning source to keep my energy level up. So the peanut butter and jelly works really well.
Let me squeeze one more caller in. Looks like we have Peter from Drexel Hill. Peter, go ahead. You're in Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call. Lynn, you mentioned breathing.
Yes.
And you said that's the most important thing. And could you elaborate that?
Sure,
actually,
Peter, thanks.
Actually, the most important part of swimming is being able to breathe and doing it in a way that you feel really comfortable. And for years, I was taught, and when I taught swimming and worked with triathletes and stuff like that, I have people go back and do the basics and do bobbing. Because what you do is you take a breath in above the water, and then you gradually blow it out, and you see the bubbles coming out, and then you pop up to the surface again slowly and do it again. And that establishes the rhythm of your breathing. And when you swim, you want to have that really relaxed breath, because what it does is it allows your lungs to fill up. And if you allow your lungs to fill up, you have two balloons on your back that help you to float in an air and be really relaxed in the water and swim really efficiently. If you are not breathing in a relaxed way, everything tightens up and your balloons only halfway fill, and then you tighten up and then you don't swim at a very high level in the water. There's a huge difference in body type and the ability but to swim and feel comfortable, but the most important thing is to think that you swim through the water. You never swim on top of it. Even if you're a really buoyant person, you still swim through the water.
Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We're almost out of time here. Do you have a next swim that you're planning for or preparing for?
Actually, right now I'm just enjoying being in the water, and I'm sort of going back to the basics, and I am going it like I was a couple days ago. I was in Chicago, so I swam with an old friend of mine from UC Santa Barbara, and we just went swimming in Lake Michigan, and it was just so fantastic. And so that's what I'm hoping to do. I heard about a great place in Miami that I'm hoping to do in the next couple days.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much, Lynn Cox, for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Marty. It was fantastic.
It was great for us as well. And her book is called Open Water Swimming Manual, an expert survival guide for triathletes and open water swimmers. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. We have posted a picture of our guest, Lynn Cox, on our Facebook page. Nick Sessler, our intern for today's edition of Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.